As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Everybody, welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens. We're June 17th. Montreal Canadiens that have been winning, that have won the second game of their series against the Vegas Golden Knights. I'm Marc-Antoine Godin alongside Arpin Basu. Arpin, how are you today?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. It's a nice day in Montreal. We're going to be attending a hockey game tomorrow night at the Bell Centre with 3,500 fans. Canadiens, for a third series in a row, have taken home ice advantage away from the home team after going on the road and getting a split against Toronto, going on the road and winning two games in Winnipeg. Now they've gone to Vegas and gotten the split they needed. Pretty interesting two games, I think. I was really looking forward to this series more so than the other series because, you know, Vegas and Montreal haven't played in so long. You know, the Islanders and the Lightning played in the conference final last year, but these are really two teams that we had no idea how they would really match up. I mean, there's only so much you can do when you're not facing the same opposition. And I think there was an assumption that the Canadiens were going to get skated right out of the rink in both games. I feel in both games, the Canadiens showed that when they are firing on all cylinders, they can skate with that team. They can skate with the Vegas Golden Knights. I think in the first game, they cut their own legs out from under them by taking all those stupid penalties. But in game two, even though Vegas had a very significant pushback in the second period, as we've seen throughout these playoffs, that 2-0 lead for the Canadiens is right in their wheelhouse in terms of protecting that and playing with it, even though they probably could have done a better job of that.
Yeah. And also that I think that you say that when they're firing on cylinders, they can skate with them. There's no doubt about that. I think the fact that the Golden Knights have scored four of their six goals so far in those first two games off a defensive zone, well, in their case, an offensive zone faceoff that they've won, and a shot from the point, whether it was deflected, redirected, or went directly in the net, it's four of those six goals have been scored the same way. And I find that if the Canadiens manage to fix that one technical aspect, that I think is eminently coachable. The rest in the flow of the game, the rest of the game, the Canadiens have done a great job in containing, you know, what Mark Stone and Max Pacioretty or the Carlson-Marchessault duo. We've seen the best of the Montreal Canadiens offense either. So if you take both, I think that it's very encouraging to see them splitting those first two games because they haven't been dominated at all, even though in both cases, second half of both games was more tilted towards the Golden Knights. But that's something that both teams have showed in the past, the Canadiens being stronger in the first period and the Golden Knights being stronger later in games.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that in a second. So we got obviously a jam-packed show. We're going to try and sum up what happened in these first two games. We're going to get to the Jeff Petrie conversation. We will talk about the officiating a little bit. We'll talk about Shea Weber and what he's been able to do. And I think a little bit from Dominique Ducharme, who revealed a little bit of himself. Again, something else, a philosophical kind of thing that he has that kind of relates to what we're talking about here. But let's start with Jeff Petrie, because neither you nor I really focused on the Jeff Petrie angle after game two. Let's just address the situation with Jeff Petrie's eyes. He's obviously a little self-conscious about it. You know, seemingly related to perhaps painkillers being used for his injury, or there's something going on there that really doesn't impede his ability to see or play in any way. It's really his right hand, the two fingers on his right hand that got caught in that photo hole that are the biggest impediment. But I think there was a bit of an impediment at home for Jeff Petrie about his eyes. Let's hear him talk about that.
Kids are at school when I came home, and my wife gave him a warning, and they came in, didn't want to look at me, and decided that I would be the villain and they'd be the superheroes, and we started playing. So that got him to relax and feel a little bit more comfortable now.
I think it's endearing to a certain extent to hear him say that. I can totally picture kids that are what, 4 and 6, I think, something like that, or 4 and 7, to look at their dad and seeing him like as a quasi monster with his red eyes. It must have been pretty shocking to those kids to see their dad coming at home like that. Because we must mention the fact that Jeff Petrie's been like that, even though the cameras caught him looking like this only yesterday against the Golden Knights. That's been his situation for the past few days.
Yeah, so you know, his teammates weren't all that shocked. Joel Edmondson mentioned how it's a little scary, but it didn't seem to affect him. And so if it's scary to Joel Edmondson, you can imagine what it would be to Jeff's two boys. Although, you know, listening to that clip, I couldn't help but feel like Petrie was a little sad about it, like that his boys didn't want to look at him. So, but really the most important thing was his ability to handle the puck and shoot the puck and play with the puck in game two. I found it interesting that Dominique Ducharme showed no, or I guess Luke Richardson in concert with Dominique Ducharme showed no reluctance to put him in every situation right off the bat. I think in the first 7 minutes, he played four shifts. I think his first shift was against that Stone Pacioretty unit, which is obviously missing Chandler Stephenson, which is a big development in the series as well. But there was no attempt to hide him in any way, shape, or form. They were going to see what he could do. And Dominique Ducharme, he said it. And I got to say one thing about Dominique Ducharme is that he's pretty transparent. And he was like, if Jeff Petrie's playing, it means he's able to play.
Exactly.
He will be able to do everything that he is able to do. We will not play him otherwise. And based on how Jeff Petrie played, I would say that he held true to that. I mean, there was one chance early in the first period. I think it was off a Josh Anderson rush where Petrie got it on the weak side. Fleury was out of position. If he'd been able to get the puck under the bar, that would have been a goal. And I think we've seen Jeff Petrie score on a shot like that many times. He was not able to get it up and wound up shooting it into Fleury's stomach instead. At that point, I wondered if the right hand and having those two fingers be on the hand that he's literally shooting the puck with, the bottom hand on his stick, I wondered if that affected him. But I think as the game went on, we just saw him adapting to his reality, I think. And even when even the goal that Tyler Toffoli scored, where Petrie kind of walked the blue line, sent it to Caulfield, and Caulfield sent it to Toffoli, I was thinking in a normal circumstance, even though there was a guy in front of him, Jeff Petrie usually tries to get a wrist shot through to the net in that situation. He decided not to. Results in a goal. So win-win. So I don't know to what extent Jeff Petrie is fully at 100%, whether he can very comfortably shoot the puck, even though he did a few times in the game. What he was able to provide, I thought, was very helpful to the Canadiens in game two.
Yeah, well, it was not the best game that Jeff Petrie ever played. I think that a lot has been said about him because of the fact that he was able to play and there was a lot of drama around him. But, I mean, when he's you know, there are two Jeff Petries. There's the good Jeff Petrie and the one that who's searching for his mojo. And we see those lulls in the season. It's like that every year, although he's gotten better in recent years. But for some reason, I would say that Jeff Petrie was closer to the good Petrie yesterday. There's no doubt about that. But to me, the biggest difference is that being the best puck-moving defenseman on that team, every time that you replace a guy like Brett Kulak or even Alexander Romanov with Jeff Petrie, you improve your team. So it's as simple as that. And his injury was not an impediment to his play. And I mean, just not only the puck moving aspect, but if you look only in his own end alongside Joel Edmondson, I mean, that duo, when they were on the ice, they limited the number of high danger chances from the Golden Knights all night long. And that's what you want. Ultimately, you know, if I think that the points from defenseman narrative is overblown, especially after what we've seen from the Golden Knights defenseman in the first game. But at least what you want from your defenseman is to be able to drive the play in the other end and make sure that you spend the less time as possible in your own end. And that's what those two guys are doing. They complement each other so well. And I think that the Canadiens just a better team, even if Petrie is not at 100%. I mean, when you have a trainer, you know, creating a glove where two fingers are going to, you know, be held in the same hole, and you have like this special garment. I don't know if it's the proper word for that, but a proper piece of equipment for that.
A modified piece of equipment.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you cannot expect the guy to be as if it was any other game, but just a level of consistency and Jeff Petrie level type of play that he brings to his team, it makes a huge difference for these Canadians, because the whole season they've been banking on their top four in defense, and even more so during the playoffs. So now with him being back in the lineup, they can have that system where they go top four and use one of the defensemen from the third pairing and spot them use with one or the other. I think that's the preferred way to do it for them.
Yeah, and just to drive home your point on Petrie, you know, Jeff Petrie played roughly 6 to 6.5 minutes at even strength with Max Pacioretty and Mark Stone on the ice. Canadiens shot attempts 8-2 in their favor. Goals 2-0. Expected goals something like 88% when Petrie was on the ice with Pacioretty and Stone. So, yes, it was mainly at the defensive end. I mean, you know, the fact Vegas got 2 shot attempts when Petrie, Pacioretty, and Stone were on the ice. Attempts.
That's amazing.
They happened to be shots on goal, but those were the only 2 times they attempted to shoot at the net. So,
yep.
Yes, Petrie's defensive play, which is, you know, he's has long been underrated. He's seen as this purely offensive defenseman, but it's over the last couple of years, at least, if not 3 years, has not been the case. He's not a unidimensional offensive guy. His mobility allows him to defend as well as it allows him to attack. And so and he brings that element to that group, which is not the most mobile group. And so when you add that into the mix and they're playing, you know, Petrie and Edmondson played roughly 20 minutes. You got Sherratt and Weber playing 23, 24 minutes. So that's 43 or 44 minutes of the game with those 4 guys. You're in much better shape with Jeff Petrie there than you are with a combination of Brett Kulak, Alexander Romanov, John Merrill, who was underwhelming in that game. You know, that mix. I mean, Erik Gustafsson, I understand why he's in the lineup, but if the Canadiens don't get any power plays, which we'll get to in a bit, his utility is obviously quite lacking, because he's not the best at 5-on-5, even though numbers would suggest otherwise. But I think the eye test in his case kind of reveals more than the numbers. But yeah, I just feel that mix is something they need, that element in their defense group of Petrie's ability to not only skate up the ice with the puck or move the puck up the ice, but be able to move in the defensive zone to kill plays and get the puck going in the right direction.
I remember this instance in the third period where, Jesperi Kotkaniemi committed a turnover deep in the Golden Knights zone, and you had the three forwards that were, you know, stuck deep and had to back check. So, and the Golden Knights counterattack. Jonathan Marchessault has the puck, enters the zone, and he attacks, you know, in cross. And Jeff Petrie really made a great job at following him. And even though, because he was on the right side, he shifted to the left side and just stayed on Marchessault and eventually just contained completely the threat that Marchessault was posing. So it's that was a simple defensive play, but you know that's a good example of a guy who, you know, who helps fixing the mistakes of his teammates.
Yes, and another guy who did that last night and who's done that, I feel, in a very understated kind of somewhat quiet way, is Shea Weber. No. You know, over the couple of games in Vegas, I thought by and large he was really good. He had some moments where he made some mistakes. He's clearly playing through pain. He was slashed on the right hand by Ryan Reeves in game one. Blocks a shot with, I think, that same hand. If not, well, what difference does it make with his hands at this point? They're both mangled. So blocks a shot with his hand in the dying seconds of the game. Then immediately goes to the puck and clears it and then hunches over in pain after having cleared it. Just totally exemplifies what Shea Weber's been doing. And I feel like Shea Weber's at his best when he's like this, where you've just come to accept what he does well. And with that when he does it, you don't really notice it. When he just squeezes a guy out along the boards, not a big hit, not punishing, but physical in its own way and effective and efficient. I feel he's been playing some really good hockey and clearly his health is going to be a storyline. I think the further this series goes along, I think Vegas is aware of it. I think Vegas would love to find a way to not have to face him as regularly. And so the stick work is going to increase, but I think he's really been playing some really solid hockey and doing it in a very kind of doing it in the shadows somehow, despite the fact that he's Shea Weber and that he's the captain and that everyone just showers him with constant praise. I feel like the way he's played has just been understated, solid goodness for the Canadians.
Yes, I would give him a two thumbs up because I suspect that he's not able to raise them himself. His two thumbs. Yeah. But I'm curious to hear you on something though. Because yeah, so he's obviously not 100%. He's playing through pain, playing through injuries, as I suspect many of the Canadians players are at this point, and it's part of a long run in the playoffs. But at the same time, you know, Shea Weber is a guy who's accustomed us over the years to put up 45, 50 points a year, score some big goals, use his booming shot, be a threat on the power play and all that. Now he's 35 years old, soon will be 36. Do you think that he's come to a stage in his career where at least the fans must come to terms with the fact that he's maybe not that guy anymore, hurt or not hurt, and that you need to have probably a different appreciation for what he's going to bring as a hockey player from this point on, and that has his efficiency on the power play decreases, he's probably going to be like a great stay-at-home defenseman because he's not going to be this mobile defenseman who's going to be such a play driver anymore. So when we look at, you know, everybody will talk about his contract, about the fact that the Canadians should not even protect him for the expansion draft, stuff like that. Do you feel as though we have to, you know, probably change our perspective on what he can bring to this stage of his career?
Well, I think that's always been the case with him. I mean, yes, he put up big goal numbers pretty much every year he's been in Montreal, except for this one. He scored 15 goals last year. Like, I mean, in 65 games. I mean, it's not like, you know, so But there is always an added element to Shea Weber that you can't quantify. You don't know about. You just know it. You know it's there because everyone says it is, and you have to take their word for it. And that's you know, the rub off effect that Shea Weber has on young teammates, older teammates, defense partners, coaches. Everyone in the Canadiens' orbit seems to have some appreciation of Shea Weber's presence. But having said that, you can't go solely on that. There's an old, I forget who said it, that, you know, guys were good in the room should stay in the room kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you can't just be a guy who's good in the room. You can't just be a guy who's a leader and who does. He has to be able to go out and perform. I think he's doing that in these playoffs. I think you raise a fair point that, you know, maybe the perception of him as being a guy who can help a power play, clearly this season has not been the case. Could argue last season as well, even though he scored 15 goals. But, you know, I think it took a long time for Kirk Muller and Claude Julien to come to grips with the fact that they were better off with Jeff Petrie on the power play than they were with Shea Weber because of what I mentioned, the pristine reputation that he has and how difficult it is to tell someone like Shea Weber that we're taking you off the power play. That's happened. But it's always going to be difficult to justify the contract and the cap hit, even though the salary is going to start to plummet here soon. But the cap hit, he's probably going to not be able to perform to the level of his cap hit for the next few years. And the Canadiens are going to probably have some cap trouble. So I would anticipate that there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be unable to do what you're suggesting, there are going to be people who are going to be unable to adjust their expectations for Shea Weber. And that's fair. And that's a reality in a cap world. That's just how it is. But right now he's not producing. He hasn't scored a single goal in the playoffs. He's got 3 points in 13 games. And I think he's playing great. I think he's justifying his cap hit in this non-salary cap world of the playoffs.
Well, I think a big contribution of his against, and we see it against the Golden Knights, is how he manages to keep the opponents outside the home plate, you know, and you know, outside the slot. He's been so good, whether it's just playing the body, boxing out guys, blocking shots. You know, for the most part, I mean, he's been really solid at at cleaning things up in front of Carey Price, and it's not an easy thing to do because the Golden Knights are a heavy team. They've done a better job than either the Jets or the Maple Leafs at creating traffic in front of Price. But I feel like when they try to drive the net in possession and try to create stuff off the rush, Shea Weber's there. He's waiting for them, and he says, "No, you shall not pass."
So, yes. No, I could picture Shea Weber saying, "No, you shall not pass." It's Shea, Shea Weber voice. But yeah, no, yeah. I agree. It's
because, you know, I feel like if everybody says that that Cole Caulfield is Bilbo, well, Shea Weber is Gandalf.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, that's good. Okay, well, listen, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we got a couple of things to discuss about Dominique Ducharme and really his ascension in these playoffs. And it's funny to think where he was when these playoffs started and where he is right now. They're two very different places. We're going to get into that a little bit after the break.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay, so we're back at the Athletic Support. Obviously, as you know, everybody, we alternate our episodes from French and English. Today we're in English, obviously, and the next one will be in French in a few days. We'll see when that happens.
Probably be after game four. After game four. Yeah,
so that would be Monday. So stay tuned for Le Sport Athlétique in French on Monday. Dominique Deschamps, my God. I mean, what a long way he's come from the guy who was seemingly on the eject seat, being thrown into the wolves on an interim basis, and with a return to the team that seemed unlikely at some point, he stayed true to his message. He stayed true to what he believed in. His players have shown that they've bought his message, and he turned things around for this team. And one more specifically, there's one thing that I would like to hear you on is the fact that we've heard him, even after last night's game, say after the Canadiens had won against Vegas, he said, we're going to be better next game. And you asked him about that this morning, so on this Thursday morning. So what he meant by that. So what's your assessment on him repeating on a, you know, on a regular basis that even after a win, his team is going to be better next game?
Well, let's hear Dominique Deschamps' answer first, and then we can get into it.
We want to be playing the perfect game. And I think it's really important in a playoff round like this to build up your game and be better from one game to the other. And I thought, you know, we did that against Toronto. We did that against Winnipeg. And we want to do the same thing here where, you know, we take what we do good and duplicate that in the next game, but also challenge ourselves to be better.
This was because after game two, and he does this invariably after wins or losses, but they stand out after wins because usually a coach is pretty happy with the way his team played after a win, is he will always say, we'll come back and we will be better the next game. It's become a catchphrase of his, and the longer he's been coaching, the more you start to pick up on some of these tendencies that he has, and this is one of them. And so, you know, I thought it was interesting to get his perspective in the sense that, you know, what is going on here? Is this something that you tell the players all the time? Is this something that's one of your things that we can always, no matter how well we play, we can always be better? Is that one of your coaching tenets? And you heard the answer right there. It's saying that we're always looking for the perfect game. And that to me, is a refreshing philosophy. I don't know. It seems to me like you can always improve. And he's from day one, no matter how low things got, they didn't seem to get that low for this guy. Like, I think he did feel a little bit of pressure at certain points during the season, but did not let it crush him. And now that things are really high, they don't seem to get that high for this guy either. And it's an old cliche, but this feeling that they can always do better. And when I asked him after game two about that faceoff play that Pietrangelo scored on his second goal, which was a carbon copy of the faceoff play we saw in game one, where Pietrangelo got a really good chance. You saw how annoyed Dominique Deschamps was after game two. When asked that question and said, this is something we talked about before the series. It was not a surprise in game one. It was not a surprise in game two. The guys just did not react well to what we were asking them to do on that play. And so every time he talks, it's just, he really just seems like this detail oriented perfectionist. And I think the players gravitate to that. And I think they like that he's able to acknowledge when they do something well, but that there's always something they can do better. And he's not going to sit in front of the media and probably not in front of his players either and just toot their horns and just be a rah-rah guy, like, oh, you guys were awesome, this was perfect, this was great. Yeah, he'll do some of that, but there's always a counterbalance to that.
You can, a coach cannot ask his players to be even keel and preach that to them if he's not even keel himself. I think that it starts, that's leadership. It starts with him. And he's got to personify that. And I think that that's one of Dominique Deschamps' strengths, is the fact that that whole cliche of never too high, never too low. Well, he exemplifies that. And as for the perfect game, I think that it is a coaching principle of his that goes back to way before he was in the NHL. Listen to this. We want to bring this energy into the next game and try to be better. We haven't been perfect, not even close. We haven't been perfect. Our goal is to play a perfect game, and next game would be the right moment to do so. Well, that quote, you could apply to a number of occasions that Deschamps spoke after a game this year. Well, he said this in 2013. After the Halifax Mooseheads won 9-2 against the London Knights during the Memorial Cup tournament, which the Mooseheads won. And, you know, the perfect game, when there's a mistake in pro sports, you want to spin, you want to turn this thing in a positive fashion, you'll turn the mistake into an opportunity to learn. You know, we've got to learn from it, the guys say after a loss. So a mistake is an opportunity to learn. And I think that the utopia here is that one night, all that learning will come together at the most opportune moment. But just as you never stop learning, that perfect game only remains an ideal.
Yeah, but I do think I get the real sense that it's an ideal that he feels is attainable. Like, it's different. There's a difference between an ideal that is just an ideal and a difference between that and being an idealist and thinking that that perfect game is out there. We can achieve it. And I feel like Deschamps sincerely believes that, like, that they can play a perfect game, that they can play a game with no mistakes, where everything that he asks of them is done and executed to perfection. And if they do that and are able to maintain that, then they will eventually go on to win the Stanley Cup. So I do get, he strikes me as a guy who has extreme belief in his own abilities. He has a very strong belief in his players and their abilities, and a strong knowledge of what their ceilings are and what can be reasonably expected of them and what perfect is to each individual player on his team. And based on that, I think what he wants to see is every single one of his players reaching that level of perfection. That doesn't necessarily mean it's perfect, but it's perfect for them. Yeah. Like, you know, if Eric Staal plays a game where he has four or five shifts where they cycle the puck in the deep in the offensive zone, draws a penalty, blocks a few shots, gets a few hits, does all the things that he's being asked to do, In Dom Ducharme's mind, that might be a perfect game for Eric Staal. And if you repeat that all the way down through the lineup and everyone contributes in their own way to their own level of perfection, then you have a perfect game. So Canadians clearly haven't done that. There are always imperfections in their game. I mean, if you want to nitpick, we could talk about the Jesperi Kotkaniemi line not really having a great series so far. Josh Anderson kind of not producing, but still doing things that contribute. You know, I think in the first period last night, he nullified two icings, and considering how icings have gone for the Canadians, those are two big plays that might have prevented goals against. <Yeah. laughs> So you know, everyone contributes in their own way, but there are people who are not at that ceiling, that personalized ceiling that in theory Dominique Deschamps has set for them, and that they have more to give. And so I think until every single player on the roster or in the lineup at least gives that level or meets that expectation that Deschamps has of them, he's not going to say they played a perfect game. I wouldn't be surprised if they won the Stanley Cup and you gave him some truth serum, he would find problems in that victory in some way, shape, or form. He'd obviously be happy that they won, but oh, you know, the ideal of perfection is a lofty goal, but it's one that I feel that he thinks is attainable, even whether it is or not is irrelevant. It's what he thinks that's important.
Right. Something else that he politely commented on this morning, Dominique Deschamps, that is, it's officiating. When he was asked about the fact that the Golden Knights had not been given any penalty, and in a very polite and subdued way, he replied.
Let's listen to it. We have the clip, and so this is Eric Engels of Sportsnet asking the question, and Dominique Deschamps' response, and you can judge for yourself.
With the intensity of last night's game, not a single penalty against the Golden Knights. Is there anything about the standard of officiating that you hope kind of changes going back to Montreal here?
They were clean last night. They were really clean.
So yeah, polite, but you know, quite clearly being sarcastic there. Like, oh, yeah. And if you watch the video, you can see him holding back and being like, I'm gonna take the high road here, and but he did it in a way that made it clear how he felt about how game two went. And so, listen, I'm never one to, I hate talking about officiating. I'm not particularly thrilled to be doing it now, but it's a fact that the Vegas Golden Knights did not get called for a single penalty in game two. Easily could have been called for two or three throughout the course of the game at various moments. There's a definite game management aspect to how that game went. And I think the Canadians did enough, especially in the first period, but probably not over the last 40 minutes, to force the Vegas Golden Knights into penalties. They need to be going to the net harder. They need to be creating more offensive zone time. They need to create some exhaustion on the other side. And they did that in the first period. The more they're able to do that and carry that over into the second and third period, and I think playing at home and having the last change is going to help them do that in games three and four. But they need to force the Golden Knights into taking obvious penalties. And that's not what the Vegas Golden Knights are doing. They're committing subtle penalties that the refs are letting slide, except for that boarding. William Carlson in the last minute boarding Joel Edmondson was not subtle at all. But over the course of the game, I think the Canadians could do more to make it harder for the officials to ignore whatever it is the Golden Knights are doing and not allowing them to play a really clean game.
Yeah, I agree. I think that if they play with more speed in transition too, that's another thing. I think that if the Canadians manage to manufacture more speed in possession, they'll probably draw more penalties. I have an issue with complaining against officiating too, because I feel like it leads to a narrative where we are victims, or yeah. there's a conspiracy against our team, it's unfortunate, because you know, you could, we were talking about Shea Weber. I mean, the fact is that the is cross checks in front of the goal. If you're a Golden Knights fan, you could say, well, how come he's not called for these stick penalties? You know, well, why is it? Mm-hmm. Why is he being ignored? But at the same time, I don't know if it's a matter of the referees not wanting to disturb the flow of the play. You mentioned Carlson's boarding on Edmondson. I think that there was also a moment during a scrum where Corey Perry had fallen on the ice and Ryan Reeves poked him with his stick. I'm not sure if it was in the crotch or in the stomach, but clearly Eric Staal was really not happy about that. But of all the 16 teams in the playoffs, the Vegas Knights are the ones that average the smallest number of times shorthanded per game. So it's been something that followed them throughout the playoffs. And I wonder to which extent playing those games at home in front of such a big crowd plays in their favor, because there's always been this sentiment that whether they want it or not, the officials might have an unconscious bias towards the the home team because of the ambient noise around. Numbers don't always support that. You look at what the statistics from scouting the refs suggests, and it tilts in the favor of the home team, but not dramatically. I think it's something like, on average, roughly 55-45. But it contributes to something that has favored the Vegas Knights. And going to Montreal, where you're going to have only 3,500 fans, you got to wonder if it's going to play in the Canadiens' favor the same way that it did for the Golden Knights. And the answer is probably no.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's it's not as if the Canadiens were being called for tons of penalties either. The Petrie trip on Riley Smith, could argue that's a hip check, could argue that it's just, that's just two guys coming into contact. I don't know if Petrie intended to trip him, but he did ultimately trip him. Something that they could have let go, but I have no problem with them calling it. The Armia hold was, I mean, they could have let that one go too. I mean, if the problem I think a lot of people have is that if you're letting stuff go, then let stuff go. If you want to let them play, then let them play. You know, the fact that the Golden Knights got two power plays on calls that were not clear-cut, obvious calls. Maybe the Petrie one was because Smith was on the rush and he fell and he lost possession. I mean, I can see the argument there. But, you know, there were instances where the Canadiens were disadvantaged by an infraction that went uncalled. And that's fine. If that's the standard, then that's fine. But again, what I love about Dominique Ducharme's response to that answer is that here's what I think about it, but I'm not going to waste time thinking about it. I'm not going to get into a big thing about the officiating. Yeah. I don't control the officiating. I have nothing. There's nothing I can say or do that will help the situation. In fact, it can only hurt the situation. So I've let you know what I think in a super subtle, sly way, and we're going to move on from it and move on to the things that matter to me as a coach. And so, again, just kind of, I think another really subtle example of how Dominique Ducharme is not overwhelmed by this situation. And there's one last Dominique Ducharme thing that I want to bring up before we finish up here. It's the number of times he's mentioned when it's been brought up that this is his first playoffs, that he has no experience, that this is not all that different from junior hockey. And the quote you read earlier from the Memorial Cup is a perfect example of that. He's using the same methods mm-hmm. that he used with his junior hockey players to relate to these professional hockey players. And the 2 years he spent behind the bench as an assistant to Claude Julien probably helped him adapt that style, because it's not the content of the message that needs to be adapted. It's how you deliver it to grown men who are professionals and rich, as opposed to kids who are full of dreams, not a lot of money necessarily, and they're just at a different stage in their life. So you got to deliver the message appropriately to the people you're delivering them to. But Dominique Ducharme is really stuck to this notion that what we're seeing now is that I've been through playoffs before, and it's not all that different.
Yeah. A playoff round is a playoff round.
A playoff round is a playoff round. And he said it against Toronto. I thought it was a great quote. He said, in the history of any playoffs you could play in any sport, whenever there's a game six, it's always 3-2 for someone. And he said that prior to game five, right? So he was like, if we just go win game five, then if we get to game six, every series that's ever happened has always been 3-2 in game six. So no big deal kind of thing. And, but it strikes me that the way he's responding to the ebbs and flows of these playoffs, he is actually banking on the experience that he gained at the lower levels and viewing this as not that much different. And I think that's what allows him to keep somewhat of a level head by saying, I've done this before. It's just a lot more people paying attention now than they did back then, but I've done it before.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that he's got a room also full of guys that have been there so often, that have won the cup, it helps facilitate that message too, because it's not as though he's trying to sell something that will fall on deaf ears.
But at the same time, that's not necessarily because if your message is garbage, those guys will see that. Like the fact that he's won those guys over, guys who have seen successful coaches go all the way, mm-hmm. really validates what he's trying to do. You know, the fact that Joel Edmondson is coming out and quoting something Dominic Ducharme told them in the room the other day, or Eric Staal comes out and talks about the stuff that Dom's always pointing out. And we've heard veteran after veteran talk about Ducharme in a very highly respectful way. So I agree that it helps that they have all these winners, but winning those guys over is harder than winning a bunch of rookies over who don't know.
Yeah, anymore. for sure. But yeah, what I mean is that it helps validating what he's trying to do. I'm not saying that if he was not doing the right thing, they would identify it right away, and it probably that the Canadians would not be playing at this point anyway. Uh-huh. So yeah. Listen, before we go, the man who put him in charge behind the bench to replace Claude Julien is Marc Bergevin, who has been nominated as one of the finalists for GM of the Year today alongside Bill Zito of the Florida Panthers and Lou Lamoriello of the New York Islanders. I think that his off-season acquisitions have a lot to do with him, you know, being a finalist for that award. But what's your take on that nomination, and how deserved do you think that is?
Well, here's my take on it, is that the nominations, the first of all, the general managers vote on this award for general manager of the year, which is bonkers to me. I mean, it just doesn't make, I mean, I don't know who else would, but maybe the owners, I don't know, but it just seems like voting for your peers is strange. Anyhow, they also conduct the voting after the second round of the playoffs. So had they done this at the end of the regular season, I don't think there's any chance Marc Bergevin would be nominated. But I do think, I've always thought that that was strange, that they do it after the second round. But ultimately, what are you building a team to do? You're building a team to have playoff success. And that's what Marc Bergevin's focus has been from the day they got eliminated in the bubble last year by Philadelphia. That's been his singular focus, is to build a team that will have playoff success. So in that sense, maybe it's appropriate that they do it after the second round. Our colleague Pierre Lebrun wrote a piece talking to various coaches and general managers around the league on the record, talking, heaping praise on Marc Bergevin. He's widely respected and well-liked by his peers. So it's not that surprising to see him nominated, especially considering how reading Pierre's piece at a certain point, you were just like, you just want to gag, because there's just it was so much praise being heaped on this guy, and halfway through reading that piece, I was like, I think Burge has a pretty good shot at being a finalist for GM of the Year, because all his colleagues are praising him, and you know what, it's deserved. He did what he set out to do, or he's doing what he set out to do. He's and at this point, I think we can say he's done it, like in the sense that they're not satisfied, but he's gone on a deep playoff run, survived a season where everyone could have been fired. But the things he envisioned in the offseason are playing out as right before our eyes in these playoffs. So I think it's well-deserved.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you look at the contribution for the guys that he brought in, Corey Perry, Tyler Toffoli, Joel Edmondson. Those guys have been difference makers for this team.
Don't forget Jake Allen. Without Jake Allen, the Canadians do not make the playoffs, I'm convinced.
Oh, I agree.
They're not even a playoff team without Jake Allen. So that's a big one too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, for sure. But it's just, I mentioned those because they've been playing in the playoffs, but yeah, Jake Allen has been instrumental, and there's a reason why he was voted as the unsung hero, by the Montreal media and won the Jacques Beauchamp Award. I voted
for Edmondson, but that's okay.
No, that's understandable.
Another Bergevin acquisition. So
yeah, no, it's deserved, and I wouldn't be surprised if he won that award. Against a guy who's in his first year as a general manager. I think that
we did a great job. Pretty remarkable that Bill Zito's a finalist without getting out of the first round of the playoffs. It's very rare. Usually they are the three finalists are teams that are actually in the conference finals, usually, but at least made it to the second round because of the recency bias. So that really speaks quite highly of what his fellow GMs think of the job he did this year.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so thank you so much for listening to the Athletic Support today. We're going to be back on Monday for Le Super Athletic in French after Game 4. In the meantime, if you are not a subscriber to The Athletic yet, we invite you to do so. We've got tons of content, not only Arpin's articles and mine, but also Julian McKenzie's and a bunch of other writers that are contributing, you know, because all eyes on are these NHL semifinal rounds. So you can save on the first year of your subscription by going to theathletic.com/athletic support, theathletic.com/athletic support, and you'll get a discount on the first year of your membership. So Arpin, thanks a lot. We'll talk again soon, my friend.
Yes, talk to all of you after Game 4. Enjoy the games in Montreal. I know Marc-Antoine and I will. And we'll talk on Monday en français.